My name is Neil, and I am an alcoholic. They told me to speak right into the mic. It really is a pleasure to be here. It happens that I love this part of the country very much. I got sober in Phoenix. For a few years, I was the office manager in Mesa. And I moved to Sacramento. It'll be 2 years in October. So my AA roots, at least, are here in the Valley of the Sun. My wife and I drove over from Sacramento, and of course, in the time it took us to drive, and we stopped in several places in Nevada and made our donations. Yeah, to the water bed. The unfortunate, when I got in this morning, there was a call awaiting me, and it happens that my brother died in Cleveland early this morning, and I will have to fly out tomorrow morning, so I'll miss most of this gathering. Needless to say, it unsettled me. It was not an unexpected event, but it's a fact of life. And I really didn't know what I was going to talk about before I got here. I don't prearrange or pre-plan any talks that I give in AA. I kind of leave it up to the boss and let happen what may happen. If there's anything I can express, and if there's any thought that you may wish to take away from this convention or from my speaking at the convention, it is this thought. I love you. I mean, I really honestly love you. In my lifetime, it's been my privilege to know some very kind people, both in AA and out of AA. But as a group of people, as an entity, I don't know a finer group of people than the people I have encountered in AA. That is not to say that we are something above or different or better than all kinds of people. I mean, we don't have any special dispensation on living good lives just because we happen to be members of Alcoholics Anonymous. But what happens, and of course anything I say, and the people who have been around AA for a while know this, anything that I may say is my own opinion. I'm not expressing AA policy per se. It is my observation, my experience, my strength, and my hope. And I do hope that there is something I say may help one person in this audience. I say that almost every time I speak. And I really mean it. I'm very sincere about that. However, like many people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I am very opinionated. And I see certain things going on that I don't really care for. And the beautiful part about Alcoholics Anonymous is, for our policy as a whole, it really doesn't matter what I think or what my observations are or how I think things should be done. That is the prime example of why we as an organization have a thing called group conscience. And that is why the final authority for us is the dictates of a loving God, as you understand God, as expressed by a group conscience. Hopefully that group conscience will be an informed group conscience. It always helps if it is. But needless to say, no matter what, I have learned in the time I've been in this program that it is always best for me as an individual and usually for those around me, that I submit to whatever the group conscience may put down as policy at that particular time, at that particular place, for those particular sets of circumstances. That doesn't sway me from having opinions, and it doesn't sway me from expressing those opinions. I don't express them to offend anyone. I just say, this is my view. This is what has happened to me, and I hope it helps you. After that sort of a preamble, let me express to you that I am here to share with you my experience, strength, and hope, both prior to the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and since I've been in this program. It just so happens that it has not been necessary for me to have a drink for 5,720 days, and I believe that that is one of the miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous, because if I'm nothing else, I am an alcoholic. I probably was an alcoholic before I took a drink. I certainly was an alcoholic while I was drinking, and I remain an alcoholic today. I don't intend, at least at this point in time, I don't intend to prove that by taking a drink. And I'm sure that I won't, so long as I remember on a daily basis exactly where my source of power comes from. Because by myself, I am powerless. I use a number of sort of gadgets or tricks or whatever, gimmicks, whatever you would want to call them, to remind myself frequently that I am an alcoholic and that my life, even today, by me, left to my, just my own devices, is totally unmanageable. I need all the help I can get. I need the help that I get from a higher power. I need the help that I get from you people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I need the help that I get from the discipline imposed upon me by the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, by the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, and by that very strange thing called the concept. If you don't know what those are, buy a service manual and find out what they are. It tells you what our organization hopefully would like to be. But I'm not here to share my experience, strength, and dope with you. I don't think that's the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not here to gear my talk to make it appealing to the newcomer, because as you will hear at many meetings, the newcomer is the most important person in the room. I don't accept that philosophy. I believe every person is the most important person in the room, and every person has a purpose for being here. The purpose is, as I understand it, there's somebody out there yet that needs your experience, strength, and hope to guide them to this program of recovery. Now, again, that is my own personal view. I don't accept the theory that alcohol is a drug and a drug is a drug is a drug. I've talked to people who know something about that, and they assure me that drugs are different. One drug does one thing, another drug does another. I do accept the fact that we as a group of people tend to be compulsive in our behavior. And the chances are, if we're an alcoholic and we should take up whatever drug happens to be popular at any particular time, we will probably become addicted to that. But we get addicted to behavior also as a group of people. And I think the bottom line for us is, if one works, two's better. You know, and four is probably going to cure everything. Again, I'm expressing my own opinion. But it worries me when I see meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous geared to placate the newcomers. I see meetings being conformed to the newcomer instead of seeing newcomers being conformed to the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I don't know what newcomers need specifically, but I can tell you what I needed was discipline, given in a loving and sharing manner. I don't think it's necessary for somebody to stand up and dictate to you what you should and should not do. I think the point of the whole deal is, this is what I did, and this is what happened to me. And that's my purpose. What I did was not take a drink till I was 16 years old. I drank from the time I was 16 till I was just under 25 years old. I got married just before I was 25. I got married on Halloween of 1959. And my wife, after several weeks, and I was still drinking, said, "If you're going to drink like this, I can't take it, and I'm out of here." Now, it happened that I loved this lady very much. And I stopped drinking. And I did not drink again for 10 years. I know there are powers around, human powers, that can have an alcoholic stop drinking for a period of time. And I guess how long depends on the particular condition that person is in at that time. I do believe the power of human love is one of the strongest powers we have. I think there are other powers that fear, for one, anger, resentment, on the negative side. On the positive side, of course, there's love, there's human companionship, there's friendship. Those things can all deter an alcoholic from his drinking career for a period of time. Health can do that, any number of things. The problem is that if you are an alcoholic and you are relying upon some human power, no matter how strong that power is, to keep you sober, at some point in time, you will drink again. You absolutely, bottom line, will drink again. Now, in my particular situation, I drank again not because things were bad. In fact, up until the time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, those 10 years were the best 10 years of my life. Considering the conditions of the world at that time and considering the conditions of my family life, things could not have been better. Absolutely could not have been better. Things were wonderful. I was working, my wife was working, we had 3 children at that time, and things were just fine. But for some reason or other, I convinced myself, or maybe alcohol convinced me, I don't know, because this is a powerful enemy that we are trying to combat. But at any rate, I picked up a drink. This was in Cleveland, Ohio, and the year was 1969, and it was probably, as I remember, sometime in September. I think that's fairly close. And at the time, we were in the process of buying a home. I had a good job. In fact, I had 2 jobs. My family owned the parking lot in downtown Cleveland, and I worked there, and I worked for the post office. We had a little bit of money in the bank, all of those things. Well, I started drinking. In January of 1960, of course, I quit the post office because they did not understand me, you know, the big bad post office. did not understand my particular problem. Well, that was the excuse I used. And then things started going downhill a little bit, and me and all my wisdom decided that I'll just pick my family up and we'll move somewhere else because that will straighten the situation out. And I don't know why my wife came with me, but at any rate, we just picked up and moved, just like that. And in June of 1970, we arrived in Phoenix. I think it was somewhere around 100 degrees, and we're from Cleveland. We're not quite used to that type of temperature. My wife is pregnant. She had our fourth son in October of that year. So she spent that very pleasant summer in 100-plus degree heat being pregnant and not acclimatized to the state of Arizona. So you can imagine she wasn't overjoyed. And then to top that off, I was drinking. I got back the money from my post office pension. We got some money from the sale of our house. Of course, we had our little savings, and we had that. And in 4 years' time, in 1973, I was on the streets of Phoenix. My wife was in the process of divorcing me. I had totally alienated every person in my life that had any meaning to me. I completely cut myself off from everybody and everything. And I spent the last 2 years of my drinking praying on a daily basis to God. That's all I wanted to do. Just get me out of here. They don't understand me. They don't appreciate me. They don't love me. It doesn't matter that I was not a lovable person. But you were supposed to compensate for that. You were supposed to understand. Because I put up a front of defiance and violence, and I wouldn't let anybody near me. And I wouldn't really let anybody try to help me. Because in my type of alcoholism, and there are various types, you know, in the doctor's opinion, in the preface to the big book, he lists five types. I am a type 5 alcoholic. I hope that makes you go read the big book and find out what the other four types are. And my type is a Jekyll and Hyde type. And usually, if I am not drinking, I am a reasonably nice person. You know, I have my human foibles and faults, but I'm usually a pretty nice guy, and I get along with people pretty well. When I drink, I have absolutely no idea in the world what is going to happen next. It wasn't always bad, but from the point of my first drink on any particular day, I had no idea from that point on what was going to happen. And nobody else knew either, you know. Sometimes it turned out very violent. Sometimes it turned out I just passed out. I would wake up in cities that I didn't even know how I got there, driving cars I didn't even know I had. And fortunately, the last 2 years of my drinking were so bad that I didn't have a car. You know, and it's a good thing. It probably saved several people's lives because I was not capable of managing a car in the condition I was in. And that's the point that I had reached in my drinking. So basically in my life, I told a friend of mine named John today that I was 52, and I got to thinking about it. I'm 54, and I'll be 55 in November. And I told him I was 53. Now, I'm making that a public statement because I don't want him to think I'm trying to cheat on my age. I just, my mental capacity isn't all there, and I'm in a theory and subtraction. But I'll be 55 in November. So basically, I drank only 14 years of my life. Yeah. I am one of them first drink type of alcoholics. There seems to be some of us the alcoholism is just conditioned on whenever we take our first drink, because once we take one, I mean, we're gone. I don't think that's the only kind of alcoholic there is. I've seen people that work long and hard and overcame a natural tendency not to be alcoholic and become alcoholic anyway. You know, and they did it by sheer hard work. I mean, they worked hard at becoming alcoholic. Some 20, 25, 30 years, you know. I'm not that type. I'm just a first-drink alcoholic. You know, and there seems to be some of it that way. You know, probably hereditary, I don't know. My mother and father, by the way, never drank anywhere near to the point that I did. My mother never took a drink in her life. She died at 92 years of age. My dad didn't drink until, well, he would have an occasional beer at a family picnic or something like that, but I never seen a man drunk. And he drank fairly heavily the last 2 years of his life, but he was suffering from lung cancer, and it was for him, it was medication. And even in those conditions, I never seen him drink, drunk. He drank brandy. So I didn't come from a family like many alcoholics do, where the conditions were such that maybe drinking was their only escape, their only out, you know. Or maybe that by example, they had learned, and we do teach our children by our own examples, by the way. And pretty well, there are certain years in a hereditary factor, but there's also an environmental factor involved. Not just in alcoholism, in almost anything, you know, what we develop into. And that's the way, for me, that's the way it was. Well, at any rate, I ended up in love in September of 1973, and I'm not sure if it was on the 18th or the 19th of September, because they picked me up, or I went in there, I was in almost a blackout, I barely remember going, but at any rate I arrived there somewhere either on the 18th or the 19th, so I've always taken the 19th as my year anniversary. And I was in bad physical shape, not to say mentally and spiritually, of course I was totally wiped out. And I was sent to at that time the system was, you went to Lars and you detoxed for several days, and they would send you to a halfway house. I was sent to the guidepost, which is still in existence, it's at 7th Avenue and Southern. And I was there for several weeks, and that's, you know, the first real encounter I had with Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I went to Veterans Hospital for 2 months. Now, so for the first 3 months of my association with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was more or less in a confined, mandatory atmosphere. I didn't like it, but I was in such condition that there wasn't a thing in the world I could do about it. Plus the fact, as I mentioned, my wife was, at least I talked to a lawyer, I don't know how far she went with that, but I was going to put one more con on her, and, you know, I was going to play the good boy for a little while in the hopes that she would come back, you know. And do the alcoholic thing, you know. I promised everything, delivered very little. And when I was making the promises, I really meant them, you know. It wasn't that I was insincere. It's just that trying to do things on my own, by myself, without the help that I needed, without the source of power that I needed to be connected to, I just could not accomplish it. And at that point in time, I didn't know how to connect to that source of power. In fact, like many people I have talked to since that time, I had convinced myself pretty thoroughly that if the source of power, whatever it may be, existed at all, and there was some doubt in my mind at that time about that, I or it had alienated each from the other. Of course, in my view, it was its fault. Of course, it was its fault. It wasn't my fault. It didn't matter whose fault it was, basically. There was a separation. I since learned, to my satisfaction, that that separation was caused by me, not by it. Because it has proved to me time and time again how much it loves me. It has made my life a total turnaround from what it was. And not through anything outside of trying to establish and maintain that contact. And I do try to do that. But that seems to be my responsibility as far as this, what would you call it, relationship with it. My responsibility is to make this contact and to the best of my ability maintain this contact. And it seems to me, although we call ourselves a daily program or a 24-hour program, I see in the big book words like, these are thoughts which must go with us constantly. I don't hear any mention about daily. I mean, as best we can, I think we're supposed to do this second by second, moment by moment. I don't know if anybody's capable of that. I am not. So I think in their wisdom, the people that originated this program and kind of set down the guidelines thought it'd be a good idea if we give them a day, you know. You know, in the course of one day, in the course of 24 hours, even people, as obtuse as we alcoholics are, as obstructive as we are, as self-centered as we are, even we, in the course of a day, may have cause to pause and ask our view of God as we understand Him for help. And I think that's kind of why they settle on that. Now, I don't know that for a fact. That's just my own assumption. And you probably know what assumptions can do to you. But that's my stance. It's important for me to remember on a daily basis, or even better, many times each day, where I get my help. You know, and it doesn't seem to matter too much if I do things wrong. And that's kind of a funny word, wrong. That's almost as funny a word as right. You know, how do you do it right? I'm not sure. What I have come to find out is it really doesn't matter, for me at least, whether I do it right or whether I do it wrong. If I've asked the boss for help and I'm motivated by the feeling of love instead of the feeling of fear, it all seems to work out. Now, sometimes the conditions that prevail at any given moment don't meet with my expectations. Now, left to me, I could have done it better. Thank God it's not left to me. Because later events have proven time and time and time again that whatever happens, given the human condition, was the best thing that could have happened at that time and under those conditions. And I proved to myself over and over and over again that it isn't necessary for me to understand how God works. It's only necessary for me to understand that God indeed does work. And my only obligation in that area is try as best I can to maintain a contact with this higher power as I understand it. You know, I can screw up anything. Why in the world the people of Mesa and Tempe and the East Valley area decided to make me their office manager is still beyond my belief. I don't know why they did that, given my track record, you know, for screwing things up. It was probably the dumbest thing they ever did in their life. But they were guided by a group conscience. It wasn't a matter of one individual or one clique, if you would call it that, of individuals deciding what would happen. It was put up to a group conscience vote, and they voted. Yeah. Now, for my side of it, I don't know what their side of it is, but for my side of it, it was the best thing in the world that ever happened to me. I thought that I knew something about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought that I was doing a fairly decent job trying to work this program. And I thought that I knew just about everything there was to know. You know, one of those deals. I've learned since the time that I first was the office manager here in Mesa that I don't know anything. And the longer I'm around, the more I find out I don't know. And when I forget I don't know, I've got people like you that remind me I don't know. And I hate to admit it, but most of the time, you're right. What that makes me do, because I'm a prideful person, of course you probably don't understand that, being very humble and well-centered people, I'm prideful, you know. And in a sense, our very character defects, if we use them correctly, can be a source of strength and a source of power for us, to our good, not to our detriment. If it's used properly, your pride can be turned to advantage. After all, think about it. I think it's pretty well accepted, not only by the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, but by the general public, that alcoholism is indeed a disease. Now, there are some doctors that disagree with that. That's okay. And they're certainly entitled to their opinion. And it's a debilitating disease. It's a disease of isolation. It's a disease that usually takes its victim to the lowest ebb that they personally can reach. You know, that's the usual set of circumstances with the disease of alcoholism. So you would not call that a very good starting point, or at least most people would not. Now, for us to lead a good life, I think that's exactly what we have to do. We have to take what some people would call a weakness, some people would call a sin, some people would call a moral aberration. Why doesn't he stop drinking? Doesn't he have any willpower? Okay. That's how some people would view it. But we reach a condition where things are so damn bad that even in our state, we know something has to be done. I've talked to people who have had, even in a drunken stupor, have had this moment of clarity that you sometimes hear about, or this moment of desperation where they finally exhausted every possible escape route that they could think of or dream of, and they were finally forced to ask for help from some source that they didn't understand, and they don't even know half the time why they asked. And almost every time, if that person was willing to concede to his innermost self that he was totally powerless over alcohol, their situation started to turn around, and it started to reverse itself, and they started on the road to recovery. Now, if they were indeed willing to go to any length to achieve what some of those people had that were their first contacts with AA, then their progress grew and grew and grew. And what was the garbage of human society, the physical, mental, moral, spiritual garbage of human society, became not only responsible, loving, dedicated people, they became, in my view again, and I am highly biased in this area, they became the greatest concentration of people in the world. And they have affected the lives of untold millions, not thousands anymore, millions of people. Rough estimate right now is that in the United States and Canada, we are approaching a 2 million figure, although we don't keep accurate records, that's the rough figure for the United States and Canada. Alcoholics who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. As many of you may know or may not know, recently contact was established in Russia for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. To my knowledge, the last time I read the figures, we're in something like 114 countries around the world, and we have directly affected people in those countries. There are well over 100 organizations that use our steps, and I say ours in a very specific way, and they're really not our steps, you know, they're everybody's steps. But anyway, there's over 100 programs that use the fundamentals of Alcoholics Anonymous for their programs. It's proven extremely effective in such areas as Overeaters Anonymous. They have a very strong program. Of course, the first program outside of AA itself was Alanon. And it is Alanon. Yeah. So they've helped the people in Alanon, they've helped people in Overeaters Anonymous. And I could go right down the alphabet with the different names of organizations. The latest big push needs to be about children. We'll see where that goes. But the point is, our steps, which I believe are divinely inspired, have an ability to help people. Okay. And that's the way it should be. I don't believe the program of Alcoholics Anonymous' business is to be the source of help for everybody and every conceivable ill of man and nature. I don't think that's the point. I think we drift away from our primary purpose if we do that. When we lose our effectiveness as a group, when we start telling people with other conditions what they should do about their conditions. In fact, that can become a very severe ego problem on our part. Bill Wilson said, Among other things, he said, and he said a lot of things, that the teenager is 6 years old. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is going to offend some of you, but I'm going to say it anyway, and I'm not saying it to offend you. I'm saying it to inform you. And I'll again caution you that this is my view. But the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is for alcoholics. That is what it is. That is what it says. That is our purpose, primary purpose, as established in our tradition. Now, that, the traditions, as you know, or maybe you don't know, so maybe I should tell you, the traditions are established, or were established, to guide, not to direct or command, or make, you know, this is not written in stone, but to guide groups. Because the experience of the early groups of Alcoholics Anonymous demanded that some guidelines be set. So the traditions are the guidelines for the group. And those traditions state pretty clearly and pretty emphatically that Alcoholics Anonymous is an organization that deals with alcoholism, the problems caused in an alcoholic's life by alcohol. And that's the only answers we have. We are not medical authorities as a group, although we have many very fine doctors in our program. We are not lawyers, although we have many very fine lawyers in our program. We are not God help us, family counselors, and even though we have many fine family counselors in our program, but that's an individual thing. As a group, that is not what we do. We are not professionals. We have no business telling a person how to handle a medical condition, a legal condition, a family condition, or any other condition that we do not have expertise in. It is not our business. Our business is to share, on an individual basis, our experience, strength, and hope with each other, so that some other alcoholic, somewhere, will be given the opportunity to recover from the disease of alcoholism. Our real purpose, and this goes to the individual level, not the group level, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and to our fellows. And that's our responsibility as individuals. That is what we should pattern our life on, I feel, as individuals. And certainly if we have expertise in any other field, we should use it to help our fellows. Always asking, I believe, our God to help to do that. You know. Now again, that's my view. Some people call me hardline, some people call me a traditionalist. That's okay. I can accept that. I can also accept that my particular stance on anything, I will put it to a good conscience vote and let them decide. And I can tell you from my own experience, many times good consciences have come up with answers that I didn't like. And in my heart, and I was very sincere, in my heart, I knew they were wrong. How could they possibly do that sort of thing? Well, I obviously had the right answer. Nonetheless, experience has taught me that good consciences almost without fail are right and I am wrong, if I happen to oppose that good conscience. And there's very few times when the good conscience has been wrong, because probably they weren't well informed, Those times when the good conscience has been wrong and I have been right, they change. Now, if they can change, it seems this is a two-way street. When they're wrong and they change, it behooves me that when I am wrong, I change. It's not a one-sided deal, you know? And believe it or not, folks, you're going to be wrong some of the time. Each and every one. Some of the time, you're going to be wrong, and they, whoever they are going to be right. And you're going to have to change. Either that, or you'll probably become a very resentful, bitter, self-centered person. And you will miss out on the payoff. Now, I've been talking pretty much about subjects that alcoholics as a group sort of pass by and don't really wish to discuss. Let's get on to a little bit of the lighter stuff now, so you don't think this is just strictly discipline, although it's a very important part of Alcoholics Anonymous, whether you want to face that fact or not. See? And we don't have to, as a group, or I don't, as an individual, have to impose anything on you, because in the background is standing something far, far, far more authoritative and powerful than I am, and that's something that's called alcohol. You know, you don't have to believe the word I tell you. In fact, I would suggest strongly that you go check it out. You know, don't take my opinion. Go check it out. The problem is, if you're so busy checking things out that you decide not to work the steps of this program, chances are, if you are an alcoholic, you will drink again, and then you will find out from very first-hand experience the hard way what happened. You will hear people in this program tell you, no pain, no gain. Well, that's true as far as it goes, because pain is definitely a fine teacher, second to alcohol, in my belief. But I dispute the fact that the only way to gain, or the only way to grow, is through pain. I dispute that in its entirety. Now, maybe at first, when we first get here, pain is the only way to learn and the only way to grow. Because given our nature, self-centered individuals who tend to be loners, who tend to be rebellious, who tend to defy authority, we tend not to accept suggestions, maybe pain is the only way we can be reached. And at first, that was the only way that I could be reached. I prayed to die the first 2 years I was in this program. I prayed on a daily basis to die. And to the best of my ability, I was working with it. Okay. But I've also learned that practice can be substituted for pain. You really don't have to suffer all of that. Now, again, you gotta consider the human condition. There is sickness, there is illness, there is death. That's part of the human condition. You're not gonna avoid that. We don't get a special dispensation. But given the human condition, you really don't have to experience emotional, spiritual pain in order to grow. You're probably going to get physical pain because I don't know how you get around that. You can grow and mature and become happy and joyous and free through practice, through the practice of these principles in all your affairs. Now you may say, well, yeah, it works in some of my affairs, but there's certain things that I can't apply these principles to, or this world as it is will blow me away. I mean, they will eat me alive. I mean, I can't practice absolute honesty in all my affairs, because the world basically is dishonest. And you may be right. although I don't accept them. I think, yes, you can practice absolute honesty. And I think you can. Now, this does not mean you're going to achieve it every moment of every day. That's an idea. And I don't think any of us are ideas. I think we strive for this idealism, for this perfection. Again, it doesn't really matter if we are absolutely honest. What matters is that that is what we are striving to be. That's the point. And I think, yes, you can strive to be absolutely honest. You can strive to be absolutely pure. You can strive to be absolutely loving of your neighbor. It doesn't matter whether you achieve that at any given moment. What matters is that that was what you were trying to do. And in that process, which is basically our 12 steps, the working of our 12 steps on a daily basis, in that process, the first 100 people who were instrumental in developing the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous believed that God's will for us was to be happy, joyous, and free. And I accept that. I think that is God's will for us, not only for alcoholics, for all people. It's just that we're such a self-centered, egotistical bunch that two guys had to sit down and establish a contact that later blossomed into what Alcoholics Anonymous now is. And in that process of blossoming, to have to sit down and write a book and lay down some rudimentary principles that we should have known anyway and should have been practicing in our lives anyway, but for some reason or other, we didn't. At least I didn't. And I had to be reminded, and I have to be reminded daily, that this is what it is and this is what it's like. In a sense, I'm probably the worst person in the world to be a kickoff speaker at a meeting, or a convention, I mean, because I tend, and I try to avoid it, I tend to take the principles of this program, the workings of this program, the operational features of this program, I tend to take them too seriously, just like on occasions I tend to take myself too seriously. Now, in Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age, there's a rule called Rule 62. If you're not familiar with it, I suggest you buy a copy of Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age and read that and find out what Rule 62 is. It's a very good rule for alcoholics. It's an extremely good rule for this alcoholic. So just so you don't think that my life is all serious and all, you know, discipline and all, I have an awful lot of fun in that. I have a lot of joy. I've met some great people. I have been blessed with one of the finest families that a man could have, especially given the conditions that they had to live in for a period of time. My brother, I mentioned at the start of this talk, I got word this morning that my brother died, and I'll be flying to Cleveland tomorrow morning. And you would think, well, that's probably a very sad condition. Well, I guess it's how you view life and how you view death and how you view those types of things. Is it something that causes me emotional pain? Yes, it is. I love my brother. But given the set of conditions, given the circumstances, as it works out, it's probably a good thing. Now, the reason I tell you this, I had another brother who was a member of this program, and at his death, he had 11 years sobriety. My brother that just died yesterday never belongs to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if he's an alcoholic or not. It's none of my business what he is. You know, I don't know who he is and who he isn't. I know that drinking did cause problems in his life and in his family's life. Four members of his immediate family, he has four daughters and two sons, and of course they're all married and they have children. Four members of his immediate family are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. My brother was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, my other brother, and I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think this influenced my brother. I know that the last 6 months that he lived, he did not take a drink. And I know that every member of his family and he himself made amends to each other before it happened. And, you know, in my own heart, I believe he was very, very, very sincere. So I believe it was a blessing in this set of circumstances, you know, given what the situation is. But, here again, sometimes we don't realize or we kind of overlook the influence we have on other people's lives. It's absolutely amazing the influence that we have. And I mean as individuals. We not only influence directly those people that say you're married to, or father and mother of, or sister and brother of, or child of. We influence those people directly. But consider this. What about the people you need the most? When you were drunk or drinking, or in a condition that was, as best described as insane, without even knowing it, you were affecting people's lives. You can go down to Florence Prison, and I visited there. Thank God I didn't have to stay. I've been to Folsom Prison. I hope to get to San Quentin. I've been to any number of county jails. And I've talked to these folks that are incarcerated, and half of them, truthfully, honestly, don't even know how they got there. But they're not trying to avoid the responsibility of their actions. But they don't even remember the set of circumstances that directly got them there. And that's what alcohol does, you know. That's how it influences, and that's how it influences other people. But again, I'm starting to get serious, and I know I'm probably not giving the impression on this, I really am a very happy person. I'm a very joyous. I like to tell stories on myself. I'm not too crazy about the people in AA to tell stories on other people. You know, I don't think that's what we should do. But as I mentioned, I'm born in November, and it happens that I'm a Scorpio. Now, I don't know if you guys follow that sort of stuff, but one of the first persons I met in this program, she's a lady who's still around, as far as I know, her name is Kelly. She was into that kind of thing, and she asked me once one time, what sign are you? And I said, well, I think I'm a Scorpio. I was born in November. And she says, yeah, you're a Scorpio. You fit the description perfectly. And I said, well, what's the description of a Scorpio? And she said, a Scorpio is a person who likes a candlelit dinner for one. Well, I have to admit, that's me. That's the way things are. I'm not sure how long I should talk. I probably have talked too long, so I'll wrap it up. But I do want to tell you one other deal that I have encountered in this program. And to me, it expresses, I've told it before, so some of you have heard it before. I didn't originate the story, but it is a true story. I am not one of the participants in this story. Some people have got me confused about that, and they think I'm one of the people involved. I am not. I put first read this story in a magazine called The Guidepost, which has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. It is published by a religious denomination. But anyway, this story appeared in I had since had the luck, I guess you would call it, of meeting one of the individuals who the story is about. He confirmed it. It seemed that a fellow that was fairly new to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe it took place in Kansas City, although I wouldn't swear to that. I think it was Kansas City. Anyway, he was new to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he got a call from the central office, and by new I mean he had about 6 months sobriety. He got a call from the central office, and they asked him to go on a 12-step call to the local Rhino Gulf of that particular city. And he came from that time in Alcoholics Anonymous. When something like that occurred, and you got a call, you called your sponsor. And you got your sponsor, and you tried to get your sponsor to go with you, because when you went on a 12-step call, you always had at least two people go on a 12-step call. You know, for many reasons, they did that. I would suggest that you should continue that practice today. It'd be a good idea if you go on a 12-step call to take someone with you. There's any number of reasons for that. Anyway, he called his sponsor and he talked to his sponsor. And his sponsor was also from the old school. From the school that when somebody called you and said, "We've got a 12-step call, can you help me?" Unless there was an absolute rock-down obligation prior involved, they went and they helped. I mean, that's what alcoholics did in those times. If you got a 12-step call, you went on a 12-step call. It really didn't matter what time of the day it was or what your particular circumstances were. If someone honored you by asking you to go on a 12-step call, you went. You know, especially if it happened to be somebody you sponsored. You just went. Now, of course, I realize there can be circumstances that could prevent under any particular conditions. Although, look, it seems to me, in my experience, the boss seems to arrange things so that when you are asked to go on a 12-step call, you really usually don't have a very good excuse not to. Now, you're going to invent a good excuse, and you're going to rationalize it, but usually you don't have a good excuse. So anyway, these two guys went to the local Rhino Gulf, and they went to the, you know, they dug. What the general public pictures alcoholics as being, which most alcoholics are not, but a typical Rhino Gulf three-bed, downtrodden hotel, and they went to the place, and they said, "There's such and such a person here. Yeah, he's up in the dormitory room, bed, I don't know what the bed number was. I'll say bed 13, because that seems to be a nice number. Yeah, he's up in bed 13. I really want to go up and talk to him." I'll say, okay. So they go up, and it's a dormitory type thing with the top, you know, the blood on the floor, puke on the floor, bugs crawling around, all that kind of stuff. You know, place smells, urine, and stuff like that. And typical, shop house. And they go to bed 13, and the guy's laying there, he's out of it. I mean, he's comical. He's barely out of it. And it's shaking, and, "Are you such and such a person, and did you call Alcoholics Anonymous?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, I'm such and such a person. I had the coke problem. I need help." And then he pops out. The two guys are at the bed, and the young man to the program, they're young, I don't even age, and just fairly new to the program, looked at a sponsor who'd been around a while, and said, "Well, what are we supposed to do? This guy is out cold. I mean, he's not going to hear a thing he says. The best thing we could do is probably call a doctor, an ambulance or something." And the sponsor said, "Yeah, that's what we'll do, probably. But first, let's at least try to share our experience with and hope that this guy does have some moments of clarity, and maybe you'll hear something." And so the sponsor basically told this man on the bed how he got sober, what his experience, strength, and hope was. And not what this guy should do, or not who he should be, or not where he should go, or even not what he should do. But what this man had done in order to achieve sobriety. And that's what he told him. And of course, the young man, Peter Bogan, was super nervous and jumping around and everything else. And just couldn't wait to get out of there. So the guy finished his experience, strength, and hope with the man on the bed. And he said at the end, he said, "Is there anything that we can do for you? Do you want us to call a doctor? Do you want us to call an ambulance? Do you want us to call anybody?" And the guy come through enough to say, no, you've done enough. I don't want you to help anymore. And so the two men got up and they went, and they left. And they're in the car driving back to their own neighborhood. And the young man, the program said to his sponsor, "Thank you, dear Dan, get it there." I mean, that's, I didn't hear a word you said, I don't think. It was a totally, absolutely useless waste of time. And his sponsor looked at him and said, "Well, maybe you're right. But as I understand Alcoholics Anonymous, my purpose is to carry my message, as it is, unvarnished, not filled up, just my message, in the hope that it may help someone, somewhere. I mean, that is what I do for Alcoholics Anonymous. I try as best I can to carry the message." Well, in the premise, he accepted that sort of. And it so often happens in the condition of life, a later event occurred. The two men were at a meeting 6 months later, 7 months later, I'm not sure the exact time. And a man came up to him at the meeting and said, "Are you such and such?" And, I forgot to mention that when he was leaving, the man left his card there with the central office number to contact. So, yeah. Instead of, you need to have calls, this number. And the guy, they looked at the guy and they said, "Yeah, we're whatever the name is." And he said, "I want to thank you because you saved my life." And they looked at this guy and he looked at them. And the sponsor said to him, he said, "As far as I know, I've never seen you in my life. I don't remember you. Where did we meet?" And this man that had come up to him at the meeting said, "Well, do you remember 6 months ago or 7 months ago, you went down to Wanoko and you talked to a man on the bed?" And they looked at him and they said, "Yeah, I remember that, but you're not that guy. Well, you're 20, 25 years younger than that guy. There's no way you could be that guy." And he looked at them and he said, "You're right. I am not that guy. I was not the man on the bed. I was under the bed." And the story you told got me. Now that's AA and a capsule. That's the short version of what we do and what this program is. And that is, by the way, a true story. That's not just something I made up for effect. That is a true story. And that is the whole purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank Don and I want to thank the people involved in this convention for asking me. I'm sorry I won't be able to spend the rest of the weekend with you. I happen to know two of the speakers that are going to speak, and you're in for a great treat, and they'll be much better than I was, and probably much more entertaining. But God bless you, you're alcoholic. God bless you. You're either an alcoholic or you know one. And you're my kind of people. And I really, if nothing else, just trust. Remember this. I love you. And it doesn't matter. There's no conditions on that. I just love you. and I hope you can grow to love me. Thank you very much.